Welcome to Entrepreneur Clinic with me, Monique Chambers, and every week I'll be interviewing a special guest talking about how to set up a business or how to launch a new product in the local market. So welcome to the Entrepreneur Clinic with me, Monique Chambers. This is the series on setting up your own business and launching new products. This week, my guest is Edward Muscat-Azzopardi, the Director of Brand Strategy at Switch, a digital and brand agency. This week, we're going to be discussing how to identify your audience. Welcome, Ed.
Great.
So we've discussed with previous guests about having a good idea and actually how to protect that idea. But now, how do you identify who's going to buy your product or your service?
Identifying who's going to buy your product or service is essentially identifying your audience, right? Knowing who you're talking to.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. And an audience needs a story, or a story needs an audience, whichever way you'd like to see it. It's one and the same thing. And I think in the case of you having a product or a service that you want to sell to an audience, the first thing you'd want to do is figure out the story, figure out the product. So if you've come up with a product, if you've come up with a service, that means you've spotted a gap. You've seen that there's a need for something. You've seen that somewhere, somehow, someone is facing a situation where your product, your service, your idea will make that person's life a little bit better. So your product is your story. Your product is what you want to speak about, is what you want people to want, to wish for, to search around in their pockets for loose change to buy, if that's all it takes. I think identifying an audience would start with really doing a good soul search about your product. And normally that soul search is a bit of a, could put you in a bit of an awkward situation, because you're going to find yourself looking at what you've done and wondering whether it's the right thing. Have I been talking to myself? Have I created a product that is extremely interesting and appealing to me and maybe a couple of my friends? Or is it something that a lot of people would want? And so this is where we typically say, do your research, you know, figure it out. And your research would ideally be done in a way that's relatively random, where you cast a wider net. And the wider net is initially random. So when you're looking for, an audience, you don't want to waste time shouting from the rooftops and hoping that people will listen. You want to have a narrow audience, so you can tune your story to that audience, and you can save time and money and effort by speaking to them directly in a voice they'll appreciate, in a way they'd understand, in a way that will really motivate them to get up and do what it takes, actively purchase your product. And so to do that, I know it might sound like a bit of a paradox, you have to cast a wider net, because you have to go to what is essentially a random sample of a population and ask the right questions, ideally from an unbiased standpoint, to see who your, first of all, to see whether your product is actually relevant. In a way, it is a little bit better to have a disappointment early on in the process and figure out that maybe I don't have such a large audience after all, then put a lot of money and time and effort into something that doesn't actually have such a broad audience. We've seen this happen. So you could approach finding an audience in a scientific way, as in actually doing the research.
So do you do that research? Is it the type of thing people come up to you with a clipboard when you're walking down the high street, or is it research you send out a bunch of emails to anybody, or something, you know, your friends and your friends of friends on Facebook? How do you choose your random audience, almost?
You typically have an understanding of your market in terms of how wide a net to cast. So if I've developed a product that is only useful to a Maltese audience because it's very specific to something we do here, then I know that the maximum potential market size is 400,000 people clinging to this rock. If I have higher aspirations, then that will change the way I'll be looking at an audience. But the mechanism to answer your question, as in should I go out with clipboards or should I send emails, will depend initially on the size of the, the total potential size of your market.
Okay.
And then it would depend on the amount of money you have available to throw at it and how clever you are at doing it. Because we've seen cases where research has happened by packaging the question in a way that's so interesting that people take that and spread it. Okay, so you could create a sort of viral research where you'd say, where you'd ask a question and package it in a very clever story. So the first bit of storytelling comes around the research question itself.
Okay.
And try and find a way of going out there. Sometimes it takes more. Sometimes you need to motivate people by using sort of little carrots to say, do this, give me an answer, and you could possibly win or whatever. But the thing is, what you would like to do is go out there and make the process as random as possible. Speaking to your Facebook friends, for example, and Facebook tends to be a very local network, unlike Twitter and Instagram and a lot of these other networks that are really global, where the people you'd follow could be people you don't even know, and could come from all corners of the earth. Facebook tends to be a bit more insular. It tends to have sort of 90% of your friends on Facebook could live in Malta to be the same country, but anywhere else in the same city.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you need to use mechanisms to make sure that your questions do go out there and reach the right people. And even designing the research itself should be given to someone who isn't biased by your love for your product.
Or you.
Or you, exactly. Yes. The results of the research are increasingly showing that demographics are a bit of a thing of the past as well.
Okay, so that's something that we'd heavily relied on in the past to know, you know, 6 foot men would always buy, you know, a certain colour jeans and watch a certain colour game at a certain time of day.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Now this is no longer...
It's become much harder to rely on demographics, and that's probably a good thing, because the more people are connected, the more people are being exposed to the same story, irrespective of whether they want it or not. And that's the marvel of your social feed. You can separate people into what would motivate them. You could separate people by what stories they like reading, by what would make them change their behavior. And there's very little to differentiate between, I don't know, my mother and I in certain purchases.
Okay.
So to me, it would be more interesting to analyze my audience by motivation, by sort of what in the past we used to call psychographic profiling, but even that's a bit of a dated term. What we're looking at is the ability of the storyteller in this point. I keep saying story because we're looking at an audience, and an audience is basically the recipient of my story, and my story is my product. So when I say story, I'm not speaking about, I'm actually speaking about the product.
Yes.
and all the bits around the product. What is the product? What are its features, as in what does it do? And what are its benefits, as in what can it do for me, or how can it make my life a little bit better? Now, the recipient of all this is ideally someone who will be motivated by it. So I should be in a position to reach those people who are interesting to me without bothering the people who aren't, or without wasting time, money, and effort on the people who aren't.
Yes. You can tell by the number of emails you get in your inbox that you actually don't answer how many people are actually wasting their time on you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. Although typically you've shown a little bit of interest.
Unless they've bought your name from some list.
Unless they've bought your name from some list.
That's...
For a long time,
exactly.
For a long time, that was an acceptable way of going about casting a very wide net. Mm. And there were nasty practices, buying lists of random people. But the world has figured out that that's not entirely successful. It's much more interesting to have a smaller audience that makes a lot of sense than a larger audience that you're annoying. So going back to what we were referring to as research, finding the audience would depend on going out there, figuring out who would possibly be interested, and then using any number of methods to guess or estimate the size of the audience. Now, all of this could be rubbished by the principle that you could create something that people didn't know they wanted.
A bit like Facebook.
Exactly. Facebook is a very good example of it, of this, and many other products. Sometimes a product just lands and everyone is enchanted by it. And no amount of research beforehand could tell the world that, yeah, there is a massive market for it. So if you're so convinced that your product is brilliant and revolutionary, then just be a maverick, go ahead and tell the story to as many people as possible. Or get people interested and find a clever way of making them tell your story. And that's probably a better strategy. That's probably a smarter strategy. If you look back at if you look at Google, Facebook, a lot of Apple devices, a lot of products that we buy, even though we don't know why we want them or whether we need them, they're typically not based on research. They're typically based on a very strong gut feeling by someone who knew they could design the product, put it on the market, and it would cause a stir.
And almost you're embarrassed to have the previous model, even though the previous model may only be 1 year old.
Exactly.
You have to have the new one, even though there's... Yes.
Yeah, that would be... Let's take that back to the very first product in that category, though.
Okay.
Before the iPhone, for example, there were a lot of smart-ish devices. And then the iPhone came about and changed the way we thought of phones, because someone decided that we need to have email on our phones and we need to have a camera on our phones. And engineers decide what they would want and then impose it on the rest of us. And then every subsequent model could be based on research. It could be based on, okay, do people want incremental improvement? But the very first one is typically based on gut, not research. It's based on the rock-solid knowledge that what I'm doing will sell. What I'm doing will create a change in the market. And a large number of these products come about as a result of two or three clever guys in a room, come about as a result of a very powerful startup that starts off in a tiny little bedroom somewhere. Mm. Think of Roxio and Angry Birds. They knew that people would be tossing birds on a smartphone before people thought they wanted to toss birds on a smartphone. They didn't go out to the market and say, is there anyone interested in? No, they created it. Mm. And a few years later, they sold for the GDP of a wealthy country.
Mm. It's annoying. I wish to have that idea and that gut feeling.
Exactly. So especially with small companies that are still figuring out where they want to go and whether they're doing the right thing, I think the best examples for these people would come from a mix of examples that came from research and a mix of examples that came from gut. Just the powerful motivator to pursue what they know to be right and put it out there.
You just told me an interesting story before we were off air, but I think it would be good for the listeners to hear about Henry Ford.
Yeah, when asked why he produced the Model T, that was really revolutionary because it was mass-produced, not because it was the best vehicle ever. Asked whether he'd known the market would exist for that kind of device. He said, if I'd asked the market, they'd have said faster horses, they'd have said they wanted a faster horse, because the only thing they had at the moment as a form of transport was a horse and a cart. So if you go to a market and say, what would you like in terms of the next iteration of transportation, they would say, a bigger horse, a faster horse, a lighter cart. But no one would say a mass-produced vehicle that's based on an internal combustion engine. So he knew that would work. He had
the gut feel.
The gut feeling that, yes, this will work. People will buy this.
And they did.
You're listening to Entrepreneur Clinic on Campus FM with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Edward Muscat-Hatzapardi from Switch. We are discussing how to build a business plan, specifically how to identify your audience.
Thank you.
So, how do you quantify the number of product, the number of stories you need to tell? How do you put a number on it? How many do you produce?
Okay, so even if we look at the word product and the way we define it, a lot of what today you could consider product doesn't have real inventory. We mentioned Angry Birds, we mentioned Google, we mentioned a number of things. For most of these, there's no number of products that you're going to ship.
Just service it's, space, essentially.
It's just service space. Like you will need to understand scalability because if your service or product is going out to a number of people and you need to service it, you need to have it, you need to have people there to fix it if it breaks, then it will make a difference if you're serving 100 people or 100,000. But you can scale up everything around your business model ought to be scalable. And the same applies for manufacture. We tend to look at numbers in manufacture in a way that's a little bit different because there's always a way of scaling up, of manufacturing more, of producing in a very sort of contemporary model that allows us to scale up and down as and when we need it. Luckily, if your product goes from something you cook up in the kitchen to something that you're selling by the millions, I think the least of your problems would be figuring out how many to produce initially. What's more interesting is how many people could I convince that they need it?
And how do you go about working that out, or how do you go about actually executing that?
The best way of doing that is telling the better story, I think, is wrapping up whatever it is, your product or service, and packaging it in a way that people will be interested to hear what you have to hear. So here's this object, service, whatever, and it's been designed to make your life better in this way. If that resonates, if that makes me feel like I absolutely need it, I'll go out and buy it. If it goes a step further, if it makes me think I absolutely need this and everyone around me ought to have one or ought to do this or ought to play the game or install the software or buy these shoes or whatever it is, then I will become an ambassador of your story. I'll take it on.
Make it my own.
And be a storyteller of my own, right? And that makes it much easier for companies today to tell their story to a wider audience, to convince many more people to buy their product than they would have afforded to a while ago. And we've gone from the 60s when you'd place an ad on primetime TV three times and reach 80% of your audience. So essentially, if I have enough money to place my ad on TV three times, 80% of the population knows about my product. Likelihood is they'll buy it and give me more money to put into more TV and just create the advertising industrial complex. And then the whole thing became very distributed and became noisy and chaotic.
Too many TV stations.
Exactly.
Too many products.
Exactly. A rubbish first version of the internet. It was an extension of a billboard and an extension of a shop window. People used the internet spectacularly poorly initially. I'm saying this with the benefit of hindsight. But now the way it works is it's very much of a large conversation. So if I manage to appeal to the right people and get them to own a story, they will tell it to others and they will convince others and they will sign up to my tribe and form part of my brand ambassadorship or whatever stewardship, whatever you could call it. So if a lot of effort is focused initially on creating a clever story, on creating a clever hook, on creating a way in which I will convert as many people to the church of my product as I can initially, then I stand a better chance of it going out there. Mm-hmm. It has to be backed by a good product. It has to be backed by a good service, mostly. Because especially if I want posterity.
Otherwise the story will turn into a nightmare story and that will spread as fast as the good news did.
Exactly. If my ambitions are a very, very short-term one, then that's okay. just speaking from a purely practical point of view, yeah. if I'm happy selling 100 units and getting 1,000 people talk about it and then just let it die, you could have a rubbish product. The conversation could travel enough for you to move a few units before it dies out. But I don't think it's a clever strategy. We normally tend to be in business for the long term.
And then potentially wanting to sell them the next version of your yeah. product or the new yeah. line yeah. in the product, not necessarily.
And even then, having made a mistake in the first place is sometimes a very good opportunity to go after the very clever reaction to your mistake. Sometimes the first part of a story isn't very, could be mildly interesting, but doesn't go far and wide. And then a company makes a mistake and reacts to it in a way that's brilliant.
And the audience then forgive, and then they want
to... Exactly, and then people want to share, look at this.
Help the underdog.
There's this company you didn't know about, that created a product you didn't know about, and made a mistake you didn't know about. And here's how they fixed it. And then the story spreads, and suddenly out of fixing a mistake, your story goes far and wide. And so how could I have previously calculated the size of my audience without knowing this would happen to me?
Yes.
It still goes back to the basic premise of tell a better story. Package your product or service in a way that will make people stop for a moment and listen.
And to be ready to react
yeah,
to
Yeah, lives are a very noisy place. Mm. If you sit for a moment in one place and you have to wait for someone for 30 seconds, your hands go to your phone.
Yes.
And the first thing you do is open up whatever social feed of your choice. And suddenly there's a barrage of stories. And that barrage of stories is different. If I were to do the same thing in 6 hours' time, it's going to be a completely different set of stories.
Yes, absolutely.
And a bunch of them have happened in the meantime, and I've missed them. So...
But you're right, it's so when it you see the reaction of the company themselves.
Yeah. What I'm saying is that because our lives are noisy, because the social feed changes so often, your story has to be remarkable for anyone to pause on it and give it a moment of their time. Because we're bombarded by a lot of different stories. It could be people posting photos of their cats to things that have... I don't know why cats always get in the way of a terrible example. But it's cats or coffee. So in between photos of cats and coffee, there would be stories that matter or stories that are interesting. And that's where you have to put the effort into it, to create an audience where there was none.
And how do you create that compelling story to reach this floating audience? Is there a formula to go by? Is it, again, 50% gut feel? Is there some of it based on your market research and what you talk about with your mates down the pub? I mean, how do you create your compelling story if you don't have, you know, massive budgets, having spent all of your money on probably protecting your idea in the first place? How do you actually come up with that?
I don't think there's a magic formula. If there were a magic formula or a rock-solid formula, then stories would be even more boring than they are already. But if I were to give a guess, and again, this isn't in no way a scientific mix of percentages, I would say you would need a dose of luck, because that you always need. Mm-hmm. So let's leave the dose of luck on the side. So many things could happen. So that's the dose of luck is there. You'd need to, first of all, realize that humans don't change. We're essentially storytelling apes. All we've done for centuries is be motivated, or millennia probably, be motivated by stories that could change the way we think, could change the way we behave. And if you're selling a product or a service, that's all you're doing. You're telling people, here's the product, I'd like you to change your day's story to include a need for this product.
So that would be, now I wake up, you check Facebook. When I'm having lunch, I check Facebook. 10 years ago, it wasn't even on, you know, I didn't even know if it existed then. So.
The medium itself doesn't matter that much. Mm. Whatever it takes to convince you that you need whatever it is. So when you wake up in the morning, you have a sort of circle of daily needs. Mm-hmm. I need breakfast. I need to have a shower. I need to wear these clothes. I need to do whatever I need to do. If I manage to include that list of needs, that's sort of the story of your day, if I manage to include my product or service, you're going to think every day, I also need product X. Okay. At some point when you have the money to, when you have the time to, or whatever, you will purchase.
Or you're telling yourself, if I had this, yes.
Exactly.
I would get to work faster, I would.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it, get to work faster. Mm. Get to work faster is a human benefit. So the first part of the story has to be a human benefit. You have to remember you talk to humans. A lot of the time you see product advertising that includes absolutely no human reference. That leaves people cold. That'll fizzle out after a while. So the first thing you ought to do to get a story that will work, that will go far, is to prove that the result of buying your product will make your world a better place.
So it's not necessarily just about identifying your audience, it's actually identifying your story and working backwards to your
humans.
Audience.
Yeah, yes. Remembering that your audience is human, because the world changes, but humans don't.
Human behaviour doesn't,
And then, on top of that, adding to the story, adding to the human bit, there'd be something that's interesting, appeal to one form of emotion. Make it funny, make it sad, make it tragic, make it clever, make it crazy. But do something to stand out, because there's a lot of noise. So, human, emotional, ideal in a way that will get your audience to take your story and spread it as far and wide as they can.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Edward, for joining us. I've been talking to Edward Mascatazzapardi this week from Switch. Next week, I'll be talking to Peter Greck from Brandwagon about how to actually reach this audience that you've now identified. Thank you again.
You've been listening to Entrepreneur Clinic with me, Monique Chambers. The programme is aired every Wednesday on Campus FM at 9:30 a.m. and repeated on Thursdays at 1:30 p.m. Join us again next week to hear more about your journey in starting up a new business or launching a new product.